Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the DNN podcast. I'm Dr. Raywat DNN, and global health epidemiologist. In today's episode, we have another live lecture. This one I gave on the evening of Friday, October 24th, 2014, to a meeting of the Canadian Association of Research in Regenerative Medicine. As always, the slides for this presentation are on my website, dionandon.com. Click on podcast and scroll down to the relevant episode. And the topic is on values in science, which has a fair amount of overlap with an earlier presentation I gave on the paradigms of perception in population and public health. But I take it on a little bit of a different tangent. So I hope you enjoy it. Okay. So, you know, it's always interesting when I come on stage after Tien Nguyen because I work out. I'm a fit guy. But then after him, you feel like such a slob. So the jacket's not coming off, just so you know. Right. And I'm pleased that the first couple speakers were also engaging. We didn't lose too many bodies. But if we had, it would be a bit of a carb reduction program. Huh? God, tough one. Right. So when Melissa asked me to speak today, she didn't really give me a lot of framework of what I should talk about, which is great, because I can talk about anything, anytime. I'm that guy. And when I looked up CARM, I found out it's about regenerative medicine. I don't know a whole lot about it, which is ironic, considering I used to sit on the federal committee to monitor stem cell usage. Right? And it occurred to me that, of course, stem cell science has a lot of ethical parameters to it, and we can talk about that. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. The values on that slide have nothing to do with ethics. It has to do with the introspective aspects of scientific inquiry. And how many of you are health science students? Okay, how many of you are not health science students? Of those who are not health science students, are you humanities students? Are there any humanities here? Oh, really? What department? Department of Silent Communication.
Sorry, International Development Studies.
Oh, right on. Okay. And back there too?
Psychology.
Oh, okay. That's good. So have any of you studied the history or philosophy of science beyond the basic class that we get here in health sciences? So that's what we're going to talk about today, a little bit of the philosophy of science and the extent to which it reflects value, introspection, assumptions. So the core questions that we're going to ask are, how do you know what you know, and what makes you so certain that you're right? Okay, and I'm glad that Tien talked a little bit about the allopathic, non-allopathic divide and the spiritual quest and all that stuff, because that segues nicely into what I'm going to talk about. I'm not talking about spirituality. I'll talk about the academic or scholastic models around how we incorporate and think about personal belief systems and how it affects science. And I'll begin with this quote from a guy named Michael Polanyi. Anyone know who Michael Polanyi is? Ever heard that name before? Not John Polanyi, the Nobel Prize winner from U of T, who was my first physics professor, by the way. How about that? My first week of physics class as undergrad, my professor wins a Nobel Prize. That was heavy. All right? But Michael Polanyi was also a hard scientist of the early 20th century. No one's ever heard of him? Famous polymath, genius guy. And this quote comes from a famous lecture that he gave. I forgot what the lecture was called. I think it's called the Guilford Lectures. It was turned into a book later on. But it changed the way that people thought about what we call positivist science. And I'll define what positivist science is in a second. Because Polanyi was suggesting that the experimental aspects of modern lab science are insufficient to describe how we extract knowledge and implication. What he suggested was personal value and judgment was playing as much of a role as observation. And that's what we're going to talk a little about today. And in this quote here, he talks about what we are striving as scientists to do. We're striving to explore reality for the sake of intellectual satisfaction. Is that why we do this? Why do we do science? I'll ask you later. Think about it. Why are we in this game? Is it because we're satisfying some itch? Is it because we have a responsibility to society? Or is it something a little more esoteric? But I've asked this question to some of you before in other contexts. But I'll ask it to you guys now. How many colors of the rainbow are there? What are they? Who can name for me the colors of the rainbow? Somebody put up their hand and tell me. Be brave. What are the colors of the rainbow? Do it. Do it. Do it. Yes. You know, you're not wrong, but is there another answer that's more, shall we say, mainstream? Yes, back there?
Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, black.
Okay, thank you. Now, you answering your pink question there, you're not incorrect, but you've kind of screwed up my my little game here, but that's okay. But so red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Okay, seven colors of the rainbow. Fantastic. How do you know that? Someone taught you that, right? Someone taught you that in high school chemistry class, right? And you remember the mnemonic Roy G. Biv, R-Y-G-B-I-V, okay? Now I want you to be really honest with me. Before you learned the mnemonic of Roy G. Biv and you learned that I stands for indigo, did you ever see indigo in the rainbow? Right? No, you didn't. No one does. Even now, if you look at the rainbow, where the hell's indigo? It's just dark blue, right? It goes blue, and there's indigo. So if you ask a bunch of high school chemistry teachers this, they'll say, of course there's indigo. Right there, it's indigo. But in reality, most people, if they're honest, only see six colors in the rainbow. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and dark blue, violet. Indigo was inserted. In reality, the pink is not wrong. In reality, you're right, because there's actually an infinite number of colors in there. You know that. We all know that. We've all taken physics. Okay? And the guy who first looked through the prism and saw six colors also knew, in reality, there's an infinite number of colors. But he inserted one. He inserted indigo because he saw six main primary colors, knowing they bled into each other, knowing that, in fact, there's an infinite number, but knowing that we all perceive six, and he inserted indigo to make it seven. Do you know who this was? It was, dun, 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 dun. Well, here, by the way, here's the rainbow. There goes my dramatic moment. Dun, 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 dun. That guy, Isaac Newton. Okay, the greatest scientist that ever lived, probably. And Isaac Newton inserted indigo into the list because he felt that the number seven had magical properties. He was a numerologist and an astrologer and an alchemist. He had this other side to him. He did mainstream science, and he did somewhat fringe science as well. So why did he think seven had some magic properties? Because in his belief system, anything important had to have a certain number associated with it. There are 7 days of the week. There are seven, I don't know, archangels in some biblical book somewhere. I don't know. Okay? So he's not wrong. There are seven colors. There's also eight colors. There are nine colors. Any number you want. He wasn't wrong. But think about it for a second. Because of Isaac Newton's personal belief system in the magic of seven, we learned that in high school today, and you answered the question today in a university science lecture that there are seven colors. There aren't seven colors. But you're reflecting Isaac Newton's personal value system 200 years later. Isn't that freaky? 300 years later. 400. How many years has it been? 400? Okay, so today we are still learning the personal belief system of one man. This happens all the time in science. There are many examples I can give you where what we think are facts are actually reflections of someone's value and belief system. Hopefully that has given you pause for a second to think about how it is you know what you know. Let's proceed. Oh, so a belief system is a paradigm. You've heard that word before, paradigms. So we'll talk a bit about paradigms for a moment. Isaac Newton had a paradigm. In fact, he didn't call himself a scientist. Do you know what he called himself? Anyone know? His title was natural philosopher. And I like that. I don't like scientists. Science, the root word science, means knowledge. A natural philosopher is someone who observes the universe and philosophizes about it. That's really what we do. We pretend otherwise. And so in his worldview, his paradigm set of beliefs, anything was fair game. Taking stuff from the Bible, stuff from his upbringing, from his theories about the nature of reality, and applying them to his observations. Now, Polanyi also felt the same way, but not to the same extent. Polanyi said, this is what we do anyway, why not be honest about it? So let's talk about paradigms. A paradigm, we can define it any number of ways. It's a framework for understanding what we think we understand. There's a guy named Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher who first gave us the language around paradigms in science. And he defined it thusly, the practices that define a scientific discipline at a certain point in time. That's interesting, a certain point in time, because they're going to change. In Newton's time, the paradigm, the belief system was different from today. And even within our lifetimes, paradigms have changed a couple of times. And I want you to be wary of them. I want you to kick out of this experience here the idea that a couple of things. One is that what we think we know and believe are defined by values and assumptions, and therefore we might be wrong. Therefore, do not be dogmatic about your belief systems. And also that they change. Everything is in change and motion all the time. So a paradigm dictates many things, including what we're allowed to study. Here's a question for you, a scientific question. Can we measure or weigh the soul? Dun, 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 dun. How would you do it? Are you allowed to do it? Can you apply for a grant to do this? If you're doing a master's degree in health sciences or something, would you be confident suggesting to your thesis advisor, I want to measure the soul? No, you wouldn't, because you'd be laughed at, right? Because in our belief system, in our paradigm, that stuff is not allowed. We can phrase it in a very scientific fashion, you know, compared to non-soul-bearing animals, what is the weight of the soul of the human, whatever it might be, you know? But we're not allowed to ask the question without being laughed out of the arena. However, X hundreds of years ago, they did attempt to measure the soul. Do you know how it was done? It was done in a laboratory. Any ideas? If I let you loose to not be judged, and you had to design an experiment to weigh the soul, how would you do it? Isn't this fun? Come on, do it. No one's got an idea? No soul wearers amongst us? Yeah. Is that a hand? No, a hand over there?
In Egypt, they weighed the heart after the pharaoh died to see if it was lighter than a feather. If it was, then you'd be permitted.
Okay, that's a good start. All right, so you're weighing parts of the body to see where, in fact, soulfulness may reside, if it does or it doesn't. Now let's add some more measurement, some more empiricism, some more logic to it, because the people who were doing this, actually in the late Middle Ages, considered themselves to be scientists. They were measurers. So if you're a measurer, if you have a control group and things like that, how would you do it? Are you still going to? Yeah, the hand, put it up, do it. Okay, a live person to a dead body. All right, so a live person weighs this much and a dead body weighs that much. However, other things account for that. Two different people weigh different things. How could you refine that experiment? Yeah?
Values. Maybe you rate the person's values.
Oh, that's interesting. Rating values. I like that. That's not what they did, though. That's a good idea. Yeah?
Well, going back to comparing a dead and a live person, you weigh someone after they died, and the discrepancy would be their soul.
That's exactly right. That's what they did. So they had a bunch of dead people or dying people on a scale, and they watched the scales very carefully, and the moment they breathed their last breath, they saw if the scale moved. And they found a change. Now, the measurement abilities back then are not as precise as today. And in fact, obviously, there's this weight of air and things like that. So today we can do away with a lot of the observations as statistical anomalies. But the fact remains, somebody, and this was done several times, hundreds of years ago, attempted to answer that question. That's a bit of a tangent. It's a fun tangent, right? And I bring it up because that question cannot be asked today in a scientific realm. It would be considered pseudoscience and farcical, right? So how we ask it also matters. Are we allowed to ask things in a certain way? How we phrase, we spend a lot of time in this program telling you how to phrase research questions. That's not the only way, the PICO method, things like that. There are lots of ways to phrase research methods, research questions. Different disciplines, different points of views, phrase them differently. So just because we tell you it's the way, there are other ways. We are not the purveyors of truth. Truth, I said that word. We'll revisit truth in a second. What is truth? Ba, 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 ba. All right, so when we're talking about paradigms, to be scholastic for a second, they come in three domains. The first is something we call ontology, which is the nature of being. What am I? Now, as health scientists, we define being as, well, my physical body, my stem cells, right? My cellular makeup, how much blood I've got, what I weigh, my height, whatever it might be. A psychologist, in the back, or a psychology student, how would you define the human being as a psychology student?
Conscious and subconscious.
There it is. So delineations of consciousness. A sociologist would define us as social beings, our degree of interactions. Right? A theologian would define us as spiritual beings existing temporarily on this particular mortal plane, whatever it might be. So ontology is some aspect of how we think about what we are. As scientists, we're quite constrained about how we think about what we are. Epistemology is our relationship with knowledge. So how do we know what is true? You know stuff because we as professors told you stuff. Why do you believe us? What do we know? Not a whole lot. We know what we were told by our professors, which might be wrong. That's the way stupidity is passed on, by one stupid person of authority passing it on and you believing it. Okay? So there's belief through authority, belief through observation, belief through experience, belief through experimentation. Many ways that we encounter the world. And lastly, methodology. And that has to do with, you know, how we are going to divine or design our process by which we encounter reality. So just for the sake of education, here are two popular acknowledged paradigms of investigation. I mentioned the word positivist a few times. That's where we live as scientists. We are in the positivist world. And I want you to think about what that means. The positive world says that reality is real. It exists. It's tangible. I can do experiments to sample reality and draw conclusions about it, and I'm not part of reality, even though I am. We know we are part of reality. Quantum mechanics tells us that I can't do an experiment without affecting that experiment. But really, all of science makes that assumption anyway, that if I'm measuring your weight to do some sort of test on you, that my measurement of your weight is not affecting your weight. But maybe it is. Okay. And the last part there, inquiry is value-free. That's the assumption of positivism, and that's what Polanyi was getting back to, is that just because I ask a question, it doesn't mean that question is perfectly objective and sitting in a vacuum. But the positivist assumption is that. The naturalist assumption, though, is quite the opposite, is all inquiry is value-bound. It's how I approach you as subjects is defined by my particular set of beliefs, my morality, and so forth. And my reality may not be the same as your reality. Okay. And that takes us to the distinction between qualitative and quantitative research. Again, in this program, we're sort of slowly stepping towards qualitative research. I'm an epidemiologist. I'm born and die in the numbers, so it's weird for me to be talking about this. So you know it's important if I'm accepting it. Okay. But quantitative research, the numbers is subjective. I can deduce things. I can do the math and I can figure things out. I can do the statistics, that wonderful word that we all hate and love, right? I can define my variables and make conclusions, and I can do it in my office. I don't need to meet the subject. Just give me the numbers. I'm fine. But qualitative research is very subjective, and it takes time to do. I can't do it in my office. I need to actually investigate the parameters and so forth. A different set of belief systems exists in both worlds. One is not better than the other because you can't compare them. There is no external set of criteria to compare them. They exist in different paradigms. Which one offers truth? Okay, now, when you're talking with your friends over coffee one day, and you say, hey, that study over there, they interviewed a couple people, and they think they know about the world, blah. We know from health sciences that, you know, we need a representative sample to do that. So clearly our method gives us truth and their method doesn't give us truth. But truth varies. There are different kinds of truth, just as there are different kinds of being. We're seeking to measure the physical being. Other paradigms seek to measure the psychological being, the social being, whatever it might be. Okay, this image here shows us the essence of different paradigms. The person on the left sees four beams. The person on the right sees three beams. You've seen that image before, I'm sure. Okay, so two different points of view, two different value systems, two different truths simultaneously exist. Which one is the real truth? They're both true, right? That's the paradox here. They're both true. And again, my background is in physics, so I always retreat to quantum mechanics for me to understand things, weirdly enough. Quantum mechanics tells us two things can be true simultaneously, right? And here we are. So when we have paradigms, we get kicked in our ass a lot. All it takes is an overabundance of evidence from other competing paradigms to question our own, and we have to redefine our belief systems to move forward into a new set of being. We call that the paradigm shift. Can you think of some famous paradigm shifts in the history of science when a set of beliefs had to give over to a new set of beliefs? There are some really famous ones that should come to mind right away. Yeah.
Germ theory.
Germ theory. It's amazing. When I talk to health scientists, they always say germ theory first. When I talk to like the other populations, they go for another example, which I get to in a second. Yeah. That's the one everyone else goes for, right? The Copernican shift. And I'll talk about that one first. So we used to think that the sun goes around the earth, and Copernicus taught us that no, the earth goes around the sun. That was an enormous paradigm shift. And the germ theory model, we used to think that miasma was the cause of disease, some magical gas substance out in the air, and then now we're in the era of germ theory causes disease. Each one of those shifts was traumatic for society, right? The people who knew it all, the professors, the authority figures, if you were saying, you know, sir, I hear that the earth goes around the sun, you're an idiot! The evidence says otherwise, what's wrong with you? You know, we'll laugh about you over coffee, but I was wrong. So we have this problem with the inertia of belief slowing down transitions into new models of truth. Other examples of paradigm shifts, can you think of any? Some are a little more brazen and not as well known. The cometary impact killing off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That was first proposed by a geologist named Alvarez, I believe, in the 60s or 70s. And he was mocked for it. In fact, he went to his grave not being recognized for that proposal. After he died, it was finally proven that, yes, in fact, that's what killed off the dinosaurs. When I was a kid, we didn't know about cometary impacts. You grew up with that model. It was a shocking thing to accept in the 80s when it's finally accepted. Right? So that's something that happened relatively recently, a paradigm shift from one model of extinction to a new model. Here's some other ones. Copernican shift we talked about. Newton's truth. Ooh, huge, huge. So, you know, Newton talked about the laws of motion, of how the world, the universe is predictable. He invented calculus for the purposes of modeling movement and so forth. Then Einstein comes along, and Einstein says, no, that's not the way the universe works. In fact, time and space are fluid and interrelated, and here are these far more complicated equations that incorporate Newton's equations but go deeper. If you know the history of how Einstein's equations were adopted, it really sheds a light on some of the nature of paradigm shifts in society. So when Einstein was going about his business, the world was at war. So England was at war with Germany. And Newton was the great hero of England. And so a particular scientist, Arthur Eddington, was recruited by the Royal Society of England to disprove Einstein. So this upstart German physicist is claiming this ridiculousness and saying Newton's wrong. How is that possible? Newton has made for us this magnificent orchestra of reality where we can plot the setting and the rising of Jupiter's moons with precision. How could he be wrong? And Eddington, to his great credit, actually did it right, and he proved Einstein to be right and made enemies within his own society for it, because in his belief system, the new paradigm was more valuable than clinging to patriotic ideas of supporting Newton's falsehood. Right, so it took one man and some supporters courage to usher in the new era of thinking. Relativity, yeah, that's, we have that. Quantum mechanics, we're in that era right now. So Einstein did not accept quantum mechanics. He famously said that God does not play dice with the universe. Quantum mechanics is about probability, how the universe is made on probabilistic phenomena, not on corpuscular realities. And Einstein was wrong. Why do I know he's wrong? Because our entire industrial civilization is based on the fact of quantum mechanics being true. My cell phone, all your devices would not work if it were not for the probabilistic aspects of gated theory of electrons moving through passageways. So it's probably the most well-proven element in theory in physics history, and it's mind-numbingly weird. Right? The multiverse theory, parallel universes, miasma theory we talked about, cell theory was a paradigm shift as well, and of course evolution was a huge paradigm shift that we're still going through. Okay, so what's the point of all that? The point of all that is every time a new set of belief system came down the pipeline, there was trauma in society and huge resistance against it. We laugh at the people now in the past who resisted evolution, resisted the heliocentric universe, or solar system rather, but that would have been us. Let's not kid ourselves. Very few of us have the courage to accept change at that level. We would have been the people mocking those individuals over there. Right? So now, in my epidemiology class, I very often mock homeopaths because it's ludicrous. But I could be wrong. They could be onto something subtle and new and novel that I'm too stupid to recognize. And I'm guilty of this as well, of not being open-minded enough to accept the possibility of a new model of thought. And Tien was kind of alluding to that when he talked about we don't have to be in the allopathic system anymore. We can be open to other modes of thinking. Now, I can go on and on and talk about the randomized controlled trial, about how it is biased towards assessing the quality of a certain kind of corpuscular, well-defined intervention, whereas Eastern-style interventions are experiential. We cannot assess the quality of an experiential intervention because the randomized controlled trial is not built for it. So right away, our paradigm excludes things that, in fact, might have value. Positivist science is not the be-all and end-all of wisdom. So, do you think that we can always determine the truth? I'm sure you say no, of course not, because we just had this lecture. No, truth is too fluid. Truth is too poorly defined. Can we all agree on what is true? Probably not, depending on how you're approaching the problem. Again, a psychologist believes that we are defined by consciousness. A biologist believes we're defined by cell theory. Let me ask you a question. Do you know what quantum teleportation is? Okay, quantum teleportation is when we just associate two quantumly entangled particles. They separate them out by huge distances, and then we bring another particle here. We associate these two together, so now these three are linked. The first one disappears, it's destroyed. And then I can change this one in such a way that that one changes automatically. In many ways, that one is now this one. Don't worry about the details. Okay, it's too confusing if you don't know what I'm talking about. The point is that we can sort of teleport the information of one particle many miles away instantaneously to another. Right? Now consider if we can do that to a person. Teleporting a person in the quantum method isn't like Star Trek where I beam you up here and beam you down there. I'm taking all your information, reproducing you over there from undifferentiated particles, everything down to the quantum level. So everything that we can measure about you, the way that your neurons hold together at the subatomic level, everything reproduced over there. Is that you? And I destroy you in the process, because there's no way to keep you intact without doing this. Is that now you? Now, the hardcore positivist biologists and physicists will say, of course that's you, because what defines you is the information encapsulated in your physical presence. Does that make you comfortable? Right? Someone not of that way of thinking would argue, no, I am not the sum total of my atoms. I'm something a bit more subtle, a bit more nuanced, a bit more sublime, soulful perhaps. Now we're back to measuring the soul again. I can't wait for this to come to pass. It probably won't, because we haven't got enough computational power conceivable to teleport an entire person. But if we could, then the existential question becomes real, right? Is the nature of existence and being the sum totality of physical presence, or is it spirit? Right? So once suddenly, positivist science collides once again with theology 1,000 years after they divided. It's fascinating, isn't it? Okay. What evidence will you need to distinguish the truth of whether or not that is you or some perverse duplication of you? I don't know. It's curious, isn't it? Okay. What is the role of science in all this? I have this great quote here. It's great because a speechwriter friend of mine gave it. I had to give this talk at Trent University, and I wanted some important quotes to give. This was from a speech that was written for Ken Dryden, you know, the goaltender from the Montreal Canadiens, who later became a federal minister. He never gave this speech. It was given to me instead. So I like it. I like that I own Ken Dryden's speech. So I show it every time I can. Right? And this speech was meant to be given at some organization of scientific I don't know, funders of some kind. And I bring it up here because I'm showing off the fact that I own Kindred on Speech, but also that he mentions the role of science has to do with research, policy, and social change. And that gets us back to Michael Polanyi's point earlier. He was saying the role of science and scientists is exploration to scratch that intellectual itch. Dryden is saying it's for social change. What do you think it's for? I'm not asking you for real. I want you to think about it. Why are you doing science? Probably because you thought this is what you should do because you did science in high school, and maybe you want to go to medical school, and this is the way in. But now you're thinking, oh, maybe I want to be a scientist after all. Why? Why do you want to do it? Is it because you have a desire to know about the universe? If so, science isn't the only way. Or is it to contribute to the world? Or is it because you want a job? All of which are rational directions to take. What is this? Okay. I love this image. Any idea what this is? I've shown it to some of you before. Do you remember? This is a paper. Obviously, the title is Science Has Spoken, Global Warming is a Myth, published in 1997. It's a scientific paper, has an introduction, a method, a results, a conclusion, and it says that, in fact, the data about climate change doesn't suggest that the climate is changing, that, in fact, it's a quote-unquote hoax. Right? This, for the longest time, was the go-to study of climate change deniers around the world. But here's the thing. It's not a scientific paper. It was published in the Wall Street Journal as an opinion article, but it was intentionally formatted like a scientific peer-reviewed paper. It was commissioned by the Wall Street Journal to resemble peer-reviewed science. It is not peer-reviewed science. Okay? And yet, it's cited all the time as peer-reviewed science. Who are these two people, Arthur Robinson and Zachary Robinson? Are they scientists? They're actually a father and son team. They run a homeschooling unit in Oregon. Okay? Does that make you upset? Why does it make you upset?
Me
yeah.
Because it promotes pseudoscience.
Okay, what's
pseudoscience? I'm defined as something that you think is real and you use that to come to conclusions about other things, but it just has
no factual basis. Okay. Does it make you upset that Arthur and Zachary are just a couple of teachers at a homeschooling unit in Oregon? Right? Okay, that's interesting. And, you know, that's the correct answer in some ways, right? So it'll be interesting. For a lot of people, they're actually offended that the Robinsons aren't quote-unquote climatologists. But that would be rather, you know, arrogant of us to suggest that other people aren't able to do any kind of analyses. The important part, or one of the important parts about this story, is that the veneer, the power of science, the mantle of science, its cloak and attractiveness, was stolen by non-positivist people. Is it wrong to suggest that wisdom can come from an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal? In fact, most decisions are made at the policy level based upon opinion articles written in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. They're not based upon peer-reviewed science. So in one particular paradigm, one could argue that something as an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal is in fact more relevant for decision-making than any number of laboratory studies that no one's ever going to read. At the same time, they're stealing the veneer of peer review. There's no right or wrong answer here. It's just a fascinating little moment in history. And by the way, real climatologists tried to respond to this and get their rebuttals published in the Wall Street Journal, and they weren't permitted. All right, so there's a deeper political agenda at play here. Okay. At the same time, are the climate change deniers allowed to submit rebuttals to climatology journals? Right? I don't know, but that would be the trade-off. Okay. I love this story. I'm almost done here. So, this is there's a movement called Enedia. Enedia is the act of living without eating. Okay, and every now and then, somewhere around the world, someone pops up who claims to live without eat. And there's a certain kind of Enedia called breatharianism. Breatharianism exists in India, primarily. And anthropologically, it's fascinating. So a place that is known for famine, it's not unusual or unexpected that one of the things that may pop up culturally is the ability to live without eating or a claim to do so. Because now you are transcending the particular trauma that besets your culture. So every now and then, some kind of breatharian pops up in culture. In this case, it was a man named Prahlad Jani, who was a Jain mystic in India a few years ago. And he claimed to have lived his 70-odd years without eating or drinking anything. He claimed that as a child, a goddess had blessed him, and an invisible organ at the back of his mouth drips a holy nectar into his throat, and that he subsists on this. Okay? Now, people laugh about this. And why not? It's in our positivist paradigm, that's ludicrous. Of course, that's not possible. So the Indian government decided to run, quote-unquote, trials on this man to determine if, in fact, it's true. And if it is true, do you know why they wanted to do this, by the way? What was their motivation? Why do they care about this? It's one crazy old man in the village. What do they care about? Yeah. That's exactly right. Good for you. So they wanted to use his technology to avoid feeding their troops. That was their intent. So, you know, in some ways, good for them for taking a shot at it, okay, for giving the guy's day in court, as it were. So they got a clinician to hold this guy in isolation for a couple of weeks, and they watched him carefully, and then they published the results on the Indian military's website, and the results showed that not only did he not die, not only did he not lose weight, he gained weight in the 2 weeks that he was held in isolation and observed not to eat or drink. So a magazine contacted me and asked me to debunk these studies, okay, because they were horrified. But this can't be happening, of course. You find an error. So I looked at it, and that's not the article that I wrote. So if I want to debunk this, it's really easy to debunk it. How would you do it, by the way? How would you begin looking at these studies and finding the flaws, as it were? Health scientists who've gone through comparative research designs. No ideas? Well, I'll tell you. Well, the first thing you look at is who's doing the research. It turns out the doctor who ran the trials is a member of the cult that this guy leads. So there's a conflict of interest. That in and of itself doesn't prove anything. It's just suggestive. Second of all, it was published on the website. There's no peer review here. It's suggestive. Thirdly, yes, he was under surveillance, but they turned the cameras off an hour a day to give him his privacy. Really? He has visitors. Really? He has enormous hair and beard, and he doesn't drink anything, but he pours enormous buckets of water over himself every day. Of course he's drinking the water. Of course he's smuggling food. It seems pretty obvious to me. But that's not the fun part. The fun part for me intellectually wasn't debunking this clearly flawed study, quote-unquote study. It was asking the larger question, which was, let's say that the study was done perfectly. Let's say it adhered to all of the quality standards that we as positivist scientists hold dear, and they still found that result, that he gained weight. What do you do then? And I opened up that question to the magazine's readership, and I got so much hate mail. I get a lot of hate mail all the time, by the way, so you know, I'm used to it. Right? Do you know what the nature of that hate mail was? Can you guess? It's mostly doctors, by the way, writing to me. Any ideas? Yeah.
Well, did they say that there's
exactly right. They said, well, if you claim that you did the study right, clearly you're wrong because it's impossible for him to gain weight. It violates the laws of thermodynamics. And isn't that interesting? Do you see my problem or my hilarity with that phenomenon? The fact that that was the objection? As someone who's interested in paradigms of thought, can you see what my reaction might be? Yeah?
Oh, yeah, just that it's so closed-minded that they would
ever change it. It's not just closed-minded. It's in violation of a scientific method in the first place. If you know what the answer is, why are you asking the question? If you're not prepared to have the question answered in a way that surprises you, then why even do the experiment? Okay? So that, to me, underlined the problem with the paradigm of positivist modern medicine, is that in many ways, it is not prepared to be kicked in its ass. Physics has been kicked in the ass so many times. Right? So when I was a physics student, we had lecturers coming in who were talking about the fifth force, Fishbeck's fifth force. There are four fundamental forces, all these Fs, four fundamental forces in the freaking universe, okay? There's weak nuclear, strong nuclear, gravitational, electromagnetic. This defines all of interactions. And in the late 80s, Fishbeck had supposed that, no, there's a fifth force that we need to know about. And he was, you know, he and his students were touring the world talking about it. And we didn't judge him for it. That's exciting. That's great, right? He was wrong, turned out. But physics had been knocked on its ass so many times with quantum mechanics and relativity that, yeah, bring it on. What's next? There we go. Yeah. Medicine, it's been a while. This medicine kicked in its ass, and it's about time. Right. So my plea to you is that we remain open-minded such that when the paradigm shift happens, as it inexorably will, because history shows it must happen, that we are open-minded to it. So how open is your mind? And what does it take to change your mind? Will you know when you're wrong? Probably not. We won't know when we're wrong. And do you believe, do you know why you believe what you believe? Ah, did I even say it right? Do you know why you believe what you believe? Is it because some schmuck like me told you? Is it because you looked at the evidence yourself? Or is it because you looked deep inside yourself and asked, what are the assumptions you've made in your life to cause you to think the way that you do? Okay, I'll leave you with this slide. And this is an advice, piece of advice that I give all my students at the end of the year. It's a quote from Václav Havel. You know who Václav Havel was? He died a couple years ago. He was a Czech poet, first president of the Free Czech Republic. He said, keep the company of those who seek the truth, run from those who have found it. Yeah.
I want to ask a question.
Sure, please.
What do you say to someone who makes the argument that, yeah, obviously there's been a lot of paradigm shifts and it's inevitable that it's going to happen, but because the scientific method has brought us so far in the past 100 years that none of...
Has the scientific method brought us very far? I don't think the scientific method has ever been used, to be honest. I think it's a rationalization. I think when Newton discovered, quote-unquote, discovered gravity or observed gravity, he didn't apply the scientific method. He was happily looking at the world, oh, look, something's going on. Let's try to model it. Okay. I think my personal belief, beliefs, values, huh, is that we make up the scientific method as a convenient model to teach students how to think about science, but no one ever does it. Right, so let's think about the scientific method. It begins with an observation of the universe. The next step is the generation of an hypothesis. The third step is the conduction of an experiment. Then we took the results of the experiment, and then we extrapolate the results of the experiment to generalize about the universe. Do you see there are two points in that process that are innately magical? They're not procedural. Do you see it? Can you see them? The two points that require an enormous investment of personal value? Yeah, do you see them?
The idea itself?
Yes. Because the idea itself was the first one, and the second one is the extrapolation, the generalization. So Newton, let's say the myth about him observing the apple is true. Okay, Newton one day is sitting on his estate, he sees an apple fall. People see apples fall all the time. Newton said, oh, maybe that's also why the moon stays in space. Who makes that kind of leap? Okay. Newton makes that kind of leap. And he does some experiments with ramps, rolling balls down ramps and things like that. And he puts together a model. He invents calculus, right? He does so in a couple of months, right, to run his experiments. And he concludes, oh, so the forces acting upon that apple act in such a way that it forces the moon to keep on falling, but the curvature of the Earth overcompensates for the falling of the moon, thus that the moon continues orbiting the Earth. Who does that? So anybody else would have run the same experiment with the ramps and not made the same conclusion. So the scientific method is a description of a mechanical procedure that machines cannot do. It can only be done with the injected value creativity of a human brain at those two points, and that's how science progresses. Yeah.
I'd like to argue that there's a third
point. Okay, please do.
The third point is actually creating those experiments.
You're absolutely correct. Yes. Yeah, so it takes, again, a creative mind to think about how to devise the experiment. Absolutely true. But my overall point holds true, is that there's so much human creativity imbued in this otherwise mechanical process that it stopped being protocol-based at its first inception. Any other questions? I guess we're on the question phase now, because that's the last slide. about anything, because how much time do I have left, by the way? Are we done? Oh, sorry, I'm over time. I'm over time, sorry. I'll take one question and I'll hang around if you want to talk to me. And also, this presentation will be on my website if you want to see it again. If you don't, it's okay. No questions? Well, I guess I was very thorough. Yes?
So, what do you predict the future of research?
Predictions never work. No one in the history of prediction has ever been right. The future of research, if I can make a grandiose proclamation, because I've got the stage right now, is more holistic approaches, by which I do not mean touchy-feely, airy-fairy, hippy-dippy stuff. I mean incorporation of a variety of paradigm perspectives into the same question. We've seen that already with, you know, multiple methods, mixed methods approaches, but even beyond mixed methods to multiple methods. Thank you very much.